The Russian Revolution is the most significant event in all world history since the advent of capitalism. Why? Because it's the first and only time where workers have led a revolution to victory, replacing capitalist bourgeois democracy or government with collective radical democracy, replacing the bosses in every workplace with workers' councils and laying the basis for a whole new way of living in society. And yet, if you had the misfortune of studying this here at university or in high school, you're taught that the revolution was not a popular revolution at all, that it was simply a coup by the power-hungry Bolsheviks, who, after assuming power, set about establishing a dictatorship that then led to Stalin, under whom, life was worse than before the revolution, and so you should never bother trying to change society. Now, there's a whole other session on Stalin today at 4:30 p.m., given by Matt down there. So I won't really be going into that at all, other than to say Stalin represented the successful counter-revolution to the incredible events of 1917. So today I'll give you the real history of the Russian Revolution. I'll give you a snapshot of some of the amazing and inspiring moments from 1917. We'll look at how workers organized, and we'll look at the dynamic of revolution and how events unfolded, and summarize some of the political lessons for how how these workers were able to actually come to power. Because fundamentally, the Russian Revolution and the critical role of the Bolsheviks, who were the mass workers' party that led workers to power, is a lesson not in how to start a revolution, but how to win a revolution. So Russia in 1917 was an incredibly backwards country politically and economically, with very low literacy rates and a very high peasant population, which is about 90%, residing mostly in the sprawling countryside. In Russia in 1913, so this is before the war started, less was produced per head than in Britain in 1688. So that gives you a sense of how backwards the society was. Now, it's ruled by a 300-year-old dynasty under the Tsar, and this is Tsar Alexander II, whose ravings and extravagant wealth were essentially like being ruled by Elon Musk, which actually shows how little has changed since the last 100 years. They presided over an elaborate police state where demonstrations and trade unions were illegal. And so efficient was the state repression that the average career of an underground worker, activist and unionist, was only about 3 months before he or she was arrested. Now, despite its general backwardsness, there were pockets of significant development. So Petrograd, the capital, was home to the Putilov Works, which was one of the most advanced steel mills in the entire world. It employed over 40,000 workers, so think something along the lines of the population of UQ coming to work for 12 hours at a shift. And these workers in the capital were highly skilled, they were literate, they were educated, and many workplaces, including the Putilov Works, actually had underground libraries where workers would share historical and political texts. So Russia in 1917 was a mass of contradictions, combining some of the most advanced productive methods within a sea of agrarian economy, with a ruling elite whose wealth and absolute extravagance, was matched up against the, immiseration of workers and the poor. And where some of the most skilled and educated workers are laboring within a society ruled by an emperor here, who firmly believed in the mysticism of a guy called Rasputin, who, claimed he had a direct connection with God, and the Tsar and the Tsarina believed in that too. Now, nothing quite strained all these tensions and contradictions like the pressures brought about by World War I. So the war itself, all across the world, it murdered 15 million workers, and Russia saw the heaviest losses. We're talking something like 2 million Russian soldiers were sent to their deaths in this seemingly endless and absolutely fruitless war. The Russian army was itself massive, with over 6 million soldiers, and comprised primarily of conscripts who had been peasants from the countryside. They were poorly equipped and conditions were atrocious. So despite the threat of corporal punishment and execution for deserters, Over a million soldiers deserted in 1916 alone. And no war is complete without a war at home. And so a war against workers to increase exploitation and suppress their conditions. Wages were already low before the war, but by 1917, real wages in the capital were only 55% than in 1913. Bosses readily shipped troublemakers and agitators to the front lines as a means of disciplining the workforce. Food was in short supply, and here you can see the glare's not great. The bread queues where workers would have to line up for something like 4 to 5 hours every single day after working a 12-hour shift just in order to get that ration of bread to survive just for that day. And the misery of the Russian peasantry was also increased during the war, as well as millions of them having their sons and fathers and brothers conscripted to fight. The rich landlords used the opportunities presented by the war to steal tracts of land off the peasants who were serving at the front. So 90% of fertile land was concentrated into the landlords' hands by 1917. And of course, as in all wars, the rich in the cities and the landlords in the country, they were not starving. So there were mega profits for Russian textile and copper capitalists. Even the shops that still were selling in during the revolution, some of the most prosperous ones were ones that had diamond encrusted dog collars for the bourgeoisie in Petrograd. And so by February 1917, conditions had deteriorated so rapidly that it was a tinderbox ready to become a conflagration with a single spark. And that spark came from one of the most downtrodden sections in society, the women textile workers of Petrograd. So the 23rd of February was International Working Women's Day. Exhausted and fed up with the long work hours and low pay and the growing food queues, women workers struck in several textile mills. Gathering outside nearby metalworking factories, they easily persuaded the men to join them. So a metal worker recalled, "One could hear women's voices in the lane over which the windows of our shop overlooked. Down with the war, down with high prices, down with hunger, bread for the workers." In a flash, several comrades and myself were at the windows. Masses of women workers filled the lane. Their mood was militant. Those who caught sight of us waved their arms, shouting, "Come out, quick work." Snowballs flew through the window. We decided to join the demonstration. A brief meeting took place outside the main office, and we poured out into the street. The comrades in the front were seized by the arm amidst shouts of hooray, and we set off. Now, after the first day of protests, 100,000 workers were on strike. The next day, this grew to over 250,000, which is about half those of industrial workers of Petrograd. And that's half the workforce out on strike in a whole city. So the Russian revolutionary Leon Trotsky, he put together this fantastic history of the Russian Revolution. It's very detailed. He recounts the workers come to the factories in the morning, but instead of going to work, they hold meetings, then begin processions towards the center. New districts and new groups of the population are drawn into the movement. The slogan bread is crowded out or obscured by louder slogans. Down with autocracy, down with the war. Continuous demonstrations on the Nevsky, first, compact masses of workers singing revolutionary songs, later a motley crowd of city folk interspersed with the blue caps of students. Now, Trotsky's insight here shows the growing radicalization of workers as they move into struggle. And this open defiance of the police ban on protest was all the more heroic because of the history of the 1905 revolution, which is often referred to as the Great Dress Rehearsal. So in 1905, peaceful protesters were massacred where they stood by Russian soldiers under the Tsar's orders. And so the key question very quickly focused on the role of the soldiers. So in 1917, the women textile workers, many of them soldiers' wives, played an absolutely critical and brave role in confronting the soldiers. As Trotsky recalls, they go up to the cordons more boldly than men. They take hold of the rifles. They beseech, almost command, "Put down your bayonets. Join us." The soldiers are excited, ashamed, exchange anxious glances and waver. Someone makes up his mind first, and the bayonets rise guiltily over the shoulders of the advancing crowd. The barrier is opened. A joyful and grateful hurrah shakes the air. The soldiers are surrounded, and everywhere arguments, reproaches, and appeals. The revolution makes another forward step. And without the army, you know, Tsar Nicholas II, emperor and autocrat of all of Russia, head of a 300-year dynasty, was toppled in just 5 days of strikes and protests following International Working Women's Day. Woo! Yes, that definitely needs a woo. Now, no one, not even the revolutionaries or the women workers themselves, set out on the 23rd of February to start a revolution. However, it was the circumstances of the time, of the oppression and exploitation that the workers had borne for too long and had become even more overbearing because of the war, that pushed workers to fight back. And in raising the demands for bread and peace, they came up against the political barriers. And by the second day, the slogans had shifted from just being about bread and wages to bringing down the Tsar. And importantly, their actions found solidarity with other workers and with soldiers, shaking off the veil of intimidation that had held them back, and the soldiers too, who were fed up with 3 years of murder at the front. Now, the process of revolution radically changes the participants. The Bolshevik leader Lenin wrote, "In revolution, the masses, which have always stood in the shade and often been despised by superficial observers, enter the political arena as active combatants. Workers' horizons, which in the day-to-day life of capitalism are lowered, immediately get opened up, and things which had previously seemed impossible suddenly now become possible." So listen to the words of Tolmachev, a Bolshevik worker at the Noble Machine Factory, as he recounts his experience of bringing down the Tsar. "I was there in the first demonstrations and during the shooting, and when the troops rose up, then together with soldiers, I was in the arsenal of Peter Paul. I stole revolvers, rifles, I drove around in a car to arrest police, attended meetings, assemblies, and spoke there myself. In days such as these, one cannot stand aside." And the revolution also began to transform the lives of women workers and struck a huge blow against sexism. First, it changed the way that women thought of themselves and brought them onto the scene as key and conscious political actors. A woman at the Trigolnik rubber factory recalled her exhilaration and her sense of empowerment. "I can't express my joy. I considered myself lost forever at the boss's hands. And suddenly I was resurrected. I grew up." But also the leading role that women workers had played in February, their courage and their persistence, meant that male workers also recognized the importance of meeting women's demands, and especially the question of equal pay, which resounded through the factories after the toppling of the Tsar. And in some places, while workers were fighting for equal pay, they imposed a tithe on those better paid workers in order to equalize the wages until they won their demand from employers. So the revolution was a genuine festival of the oppressed, as Lenin describes them. Soldiers demanded to be treated equally and refused to recognize their officers, electing instead their own leadership through soldiers' committees. The teaching of native languages, which had been forbidden under the Tsar, was now, there was a flourishing of education in people's own tongue. Art and culture, so often seemingly out of reach for the masses, became intrinsic to the revolution. Workers filled the dance halls to see famous ballerinas and see ballets, and all over the country, theater groups popped up. And then there were the debates and the meetings. In everyday capitalism, we don't get any say over society. We're totally alienated at work and from the major decisions in society. But in revolution, all of a sudden, the ideas in our heads matter. We have control over our work and our lives, and there's a flourishing of political debate and engagement. As one newspaper reported, everywhere there were groups of people, meetings, which of late have become habitual sites, but they were in immeasurably larger numbers. Everywhere at street meetings, in trams, passionate, heated disputes take place. And nowhere was this impact of the revolution more significant than in the workplace. So this is a factory committee meeting, or a factory meeting in the Putilov Works, and you get a sense of the absolute scale of people's involvement. Now, overbearing bosses suddenly found themselves immediately outnumbered and overpowered by angry and embittered workers who began using the tactic called carting out, where they chucked a boss in a wheelbarrow, put a bag on their head, and wheeled them out of the workplace. So at Putilov, 40 managers were removed in the course of 3 days, many of them through the practice of carting out. Now, cab drivers, not necessarily known for their radicalism in Russia, in the context of the general strike of February, as they were bringing down the Tsar, the union announced, tomorrow the cabbies will not be driving members of the public as usual, only the leaders of disorder. And the taking control of daily life was crucial in the workplaces, and workers formed their own organizations, factory committees, where, you know, which were democratically controlled and were the real heartbeat of the revolution. And then to coordinate action across districts, cities, and even the entire country, workers formed Soviets or Workers' Council in Russia, Russian, in order to organize themselves and the revolution. And one of the first things the Soviets established, for instance, was the 8-hour day. And they didn't just wait for management to agree or to enter into interminable negotiations. The Soviet just decreed that this is the fact, and workers either left work after 8 hours or demanded extra pay for overtime. And here's a picture of the Petrograd Soviet. Far from today's parliamentary democracy, where we vote for only 3 minutes every couple of years, for people we've never met and who misrepresent us and are entirely unaccountable for those that whole period, the Soviets were a highly sophisticated form of participatory democracy. This involved representatives coming from the workplaces themselves and were not themselves given any privileges for fulfilling their duties as representatives. Not only were they wholly accountable for their actions, they actually lived with their own decisions because they didn't, you know, stop being workers even though they were delegates. They were instantly recallable, which meant that shifts in political opinion amongst workers could be immediately reflected in their institutions, or if delegates didn't do a very good job of representing their comrades. And so a great example of this recallability takes place pretty immediately after the fall of the Tsar. So workers across Petrograd were already strongly against the war, and yet some of the Soviet delegates who were moderate socialists, which I'll talk about in a second, they were voting in favor of the war. So at the Skorokhod shoe factory, the four delegates in the district Soviet, who were all moderates, ignored the decision of the Workers' General Assembly to reject the war, and they voted to support it in the Soviet. And so the very next day at Skorokhod, the workers recalled those delegates and just replaced them with Bolsheviks. Now, here's another view, and yeah, you can sort of get a bit of an idea of the different groups of people. And within this Soviet, you've got it's a collection of workers and soldiers. So you can see quite a few uniforms, and you can see some women workers as well. And Soviets developed everywhere, involving workers from massive factories all the way down to tiny workplaces like barbershops. Peasants and soldiers formed their own Soviets modeled on the workers' councils. And these Soviets organized everything from economic measures, such as limiting overtime and enforcing pay increases, to major political questions, such as what attitude to take to the war. And despite these incredible organizations springing up, capable of actually just running society in toto without the involvement of bosses or landlords, workers themselves had to be convinced that this was necessary. And so before that took place, there actually existed these two structures. You've got the Soviets on the one hand that, in all practical terms, controlled the cities and the countryside. And then on the other hand, you've got the provisional government. Now, the provisional government was comprised of the exact same ministers and parliamentary figures who were part of the Tsar's court before 1917. So the head of the government was Prince Lvov, and the ministers were all prominent bosses and landowners. As soon as it was obvious that the Tsar had to go, they cast him off in order to preserve as much of their order as they could. So as one participant of the revolution wrote at the time, officially, they celebrated, they blessed the revolution, they shouted hooray for the fighters of freedom and decorated themselves with ribbons and marched around sporting red banners. Everyone said, we, our revolution, our victory, our freedom. but in their hearts, in intimate conversation, they were horrified. They shuddered and felt themselves captives to a hostile elemental milieu that was traveling along some unknown path. Initially, after February, all of society seemed united behind the goals of the revolution. But despite the end of autocratic rule, the entire apparatus of class dictatorship remained, with the bosses and the elite attempting to maintain control through the provisional government, and the Soviets maintaining workers' practical control of society on the other. Now, this balance between official bourgeois power and workers' power is something that often emerges in workers' revolutions, and it's called dual power. It's inherently unstable. Both institutions in Russia were attempting to assert control and had completely counterposed interests. So initially, the Soviets agreed to allow the formation of the provisional government to take place so long as it stayed true to the goals of February 1917 and established, you know, bread for the workers, peace at the front, and land for the peasants. And despite their lofty proclamations for democracy and a freer society, however, the provisional government maintained every key issue that had pushed workers to revolution in the first place. So workers and soldiers demanded peace, and the provisional government said war until victory. The peasants demanded redistribution of land, and the provisional government said, well, all land reform has to wait until the end of the war. And workers demanded bread, and the provisional government said production had to be focused on the war effort. So why did workers tolerate the provisional government if it was refusing to grant further reforms? Well, the key issue here comes down to the political organizations of the working class. So, oh, there we go. There were three major organizations of workers in 1917. And first up, I'll talk about the Bolsheviks, which is just means majority in Russian. And they'd been an underground organization under the Tsar. They were revolutionaries led by hundreds of dedicated activists who'd faced arrest and exile in the preceding 20 years. They led the most militant sections of workers, who were primarily the skilled workers of Petrograd, and they also made conscious intervention to organize women workers, such as in the textile mills and in the laundries. The consistent demand, or their consistent demand, the Bolsheviks' demand, throughout 1917 was all power to the Soviets, that the revolution begun in February was under threat from the capitalist class, who was still in power, and only Soviet control could ensure the democratic and economic rights of workers, soldiers, and peasants, and to guarantee them and preserve them. Now, most soldiers and peasants were actually organized by the socialist revolutionaries, and some workers organized by the Mensheviks. So you can see them up here. Both of these organizations were moderate, who argued that workers and bosses and peasants and soldiers were all on the same side, much like the reformist outfits like the ALP today. From February, these moderates dominated the Soviets as workers didn't feel confident or see that it was necessary for Soviets to take power. So according to the Mensheviks, in order to placate the bosses and make sure we're all on the same side, workers needed to moderate their demands so as not to drive bosses against the revolution. Now, the bosses were already firmly against any further gains of the revolution. So all this did, all this served to do was limit what workers were fighting for. The eight-hour day, for example, was a key economic demand, but was also a key political demand of workers to allow them the time and space in order to go to meetings and be politically active. The Mensheviks newspaper warned workers not to heed the call for the eight-hour day. They blamed workers for being too radical in the 1905 revolution in pursuing this demand because it forced the government to repress the revolution. And so according to the Mensheviks, workers just had to wait patiently for the bosses to be convinced out of their power and privilege. From April, the Mensheviks and SRs actually entered the provisional government. And not through any, you know, election. There was actually never an election for the provisional government throughout the entire 1917. And they served alongside the bosses and landowners. And you can see in the middle there, Kerensky, he becomes prime minister and leads the provisional government in the latter half of the of 1917. And so while in the provisional government, they used their leadership of the Soviets to make them politically subservient to the government, with a constant refrain that workers' demands had to take a back seat to winning the war. but a growing economic crisis and heavy losses at the front pushed workers to draw more radical conclusions. In late April, 2 months following the downfall of the Tsar and of, you know, 2 months of experiencing the provisional government, the General Assembly of the Nevskaya Thread Mill, so this is a textile mill dominated by women, declared the bourgeois government is not making errors, but is following a conscious plan to dupe the people of Russia and other countries. Experience of the limitations of bourgeois democratic rule was pushing workers more and more to agree with the Bolshevik slogan of all power to the Soviets. And the ruling class, for their part, were also bitterly hostile to the existence of the Soviets and getting impatient with the lack of action by the provisional government, and also sought to resolve the situation in their favour. Firstly, they started using their economic power, their rule in the factories, to actually just shut down production in Petrograd and try to actually sack workers and shift factories to the countryside in a process called unloading. So the Petrograd Textile Workers Union reported that in one of their mills, management had told workers that it had to reduce production because of a shortage of raw material. But at the very same time, raw cotton was being taken out of the mill and then shipped off. In June, the military brought back the death penalty, and the soldiers' elected committees lost their right to remove commanders or interfere with battle orders. As a Bolshevik reported to the factory committee's conference in July, the disgraceful legacy of the past is being restored. Capital punishment, administrative exile and arrests, attacks on workers' organisations and their press, these are striking manifestations of counter-revolution that are occurring in plain view. And the bosses' counter-revolution crystallised in August around the commander-in-chief of the Russian army, General Kornilov. So Kornilov had been appointed this position by Kerensky, who was, remember, he was a socialist revolutionary, Kerensky, eager to suppress the Bolsheviks and establish control over the Soviets. So Kornilov was summoned to assemble troops from the front and march on Petrograd. Behind him was suddenly revealed the mailed fist of the bourgeoisie, boldly attempting to crush the revolution. It was this coup more than anything else that solidified the argument that the Bolsheviks had been waging throughout 1917. There was no parliamentary solution that would resolve the demands of the people. The choices were either bourgeois dictatorship or workers' control in the Soviets. And sadly enough for the provisional government, Kornilov planned not just to put the Soviets to the sword, but the provisional government as well, and install himself as a dictator. When they realized this, the provisional government sounded the alarm, mobilized the Bolsheviks, released a whole bunch of them from prison, who in turn mobilized the mass of the working class across Petrograd to defend the city and destroy the coup entirely before it began. And so Kornilov was stopped within a few short days without a single shot being fired, because all the logistical aspects of a coup and mobilizing an army become a question of class control. To get an army anywhere, you need to use a train. And who controls a train? Well, it's train workers. So troops on a train, you know, destined, you know, taking them from the front to Petrograd, suddenly find themselves in the countryside miles away. Tracks were also ripped up. So they'd actually just remove train tracks when Kornilov's, you know, started actually commandeering his own train carriages. To send messages anywhere, you need to use the telegram service. And so what would happen is that messages from the general to his staff were actually just rerouted to the Bolsheviks, and the wrong messages sent in return. Secret or private messages between those at the top of Kornilov's apparatus, they were printed out onto posters and plastered all over the city saying, this is what they've got in plan for us. Agitators were sent out to meet Kornilov's troops. So since Kornilov could offer nothing to his overwhelmingly peasant, you know, troops except their continued oppression, the troops literally just melted away and joined the Reds. Arms workers in Petrograd began producing not to fill orders, but to produce for the Soviets. So the Putilov works actually just starts making cannon, and they produce within a couple of days, they produce 100 cannon for the Soviets. Fortunately, however, the coup's totally defeated without them having to be used. There we go. And in the aftermath of the coup's collapse, the idea that there's some parliamentary solution or path to socialism also completely collapsed. The Bolshevik slogan of all power to the Soviets was voted up across all manner of Soviets, you know, in the workers' Soviets, in the soldiers' Soviets and peasant Soviets throughout Russia. Recall elections take place and the Bolsheviks win clear majorities in factory committees and in Soviets. So they end up having 90% of the Soviets across Petrograd and 60% across Moscow. Trotsky himself is elected chairman of the Petrograd Council of Soviets. And on October 25, the All-Russian Congress of Soviets was convened, comprising hundreds of delegates from all the different Soviets across Russia. It votes overwhelmingly in favor of Soviet power and the dissolution of bourgeois rule. At the same time, soldiers under the command of the Soviets stood guard at the critical infrastructure points across the capital, and a detachment was sent into the palace, which is the seat of the provisional government, and just dissolved them. And there's no one left to defend the provisional government. So this supposed coup that, you know, is actually being carried out by the vast majority of society for the first time, democratically assuming power for themselves, takes place with very little bloodshed and ushered in a whole new era of running society. So the gains of this second revolution of workers coming to power can't be understated. The biggest gain that we can say is that it is that Soviet rule and workers' rule in the workplaces was established. No more would workers be subjected to the petty dictatorship of managers and bosses who only care for profit. Workers had complete democratic control over their work and working lives. The hours, wages, conditions, and the very nature of work itself came under democratic control. The schools in the new year in 1918, they couldn't actually start on time because teachers were still debating the best methods of instruction. Equal pay between men and women was granted overnight. Some 125,000 literacy schools were set up and factories established education commissions. And in the space of 6 years, literacy rates tripled. And a range of civil liberties and social changes were granted with Soviet rule as well. So because the majority of society was controlling society for the first time, they had no interest in oppression. The Russian Empire was just immediately disbanded and oppressed nations given self-determination. Where once only Russian was taught and other languages forbidden, now instruction took place in people's native tongue, and it was illegal to teach in white Russian if you're in a different ethnic group. Not only did women have equal pay and vote through the Soviets, but domestic labor was socialized to lift the burden from women in the home. And so communal kitchens, laundry, and childcare were established by the Soviets. Equal access was granted for divorce and inheritance rights were abolished. Free abortion on demand was provided by the state, something that we actually don't even have in the 21st century. Equal marriage rights were granted to LGBTI couples. Anti-Semitism, a key plank of the Tsarist rule used to scapegoat Jews and whip up pogroms, became illegal, and the fascistic Black Hundreds were criminalized. One of the other critical decrees was for peace. And Russia's withdrawal from World War I, which took place a couple of months later in negotiations with Germany, that precipitated actually the end of World War I itself. And it's something we're never taught about. But the Russian Revolution and subsequent withdrawal from the war inspires uprisings, mutinies, and revolutions all throughout the world, but importantly in Germany. The end of World War I and the Treaty of Versailles only took place because German soldiers and workers had their own revolution inspired by Russia and overthrew their own hated monarch in November 1918. And not only did this revolutionary wave end the war, but it sweeps through Europe, bringing Soviet rule to Hungary and Finland, and workers' councils are established in Germany and Italy, and there's also a wave of anti-colonial revolts throughout the world. Now, I started this talk by arguing that Russia 1917 is a lesson in how to win a revolution, because it wasn't a foregone conclusion that workers would take power. Without the Bolshevik Party, the revolution would have been defeated. Revolutions are a political contest. And at the start of the revolution, the moderates used their significant influence and institutional power to again and again denigrate workers' instincts and desire for more than just a new figurehead and the continuation of class rule. After October, despite their claims to love democracy and, you know, therefore some peaceful transition to address workers' interests, the moderate socialists who had supported the slaughter of World War I, we shouldn't forget that, and who also again and again refused to heed the demands of workers and peasants, these moderate socialists actually just quit the Soviets, quit the democratic space, and joined forces with the bosses, fomenting civil war and mobilizing right-wing troops to attempt to retake power. And despite the incredible history of revolutions throughout the whole of the last 100 years, and even when workers have themselves formed, you know, Soviets or their own workers' councils, such as in Germany, 1918, Hungary in 56, Chile in 73, Portugal in 74, Iran in 79, Poland in 1980, there's all these incredibly inspiring workers' revolutions, but without a revolutionary organization cohered around the politics of Marxism and workers' power well before revolution, these revolutions have actually gone down to defeat and workers disarmed primarily by the politics of reformism. And that's why the Russian Revolution is so incredible, because it shows that workers' power is possible and what a beautiful world we can build. In the words of the sword of the revolution, Leon Trotsky, that radiant future in which, you know, we become master of the drifting stream of history, will become master of the drift. Totally butchered it. My apologies. Okay. That radiant future in which we will become master of the drifting stream of history and direct it towards the boundless horizon of beauty, joy, and happiness. No, thank you.